This evening, then, we will begin our summer study of the Bhagavad Gita. And as we usually do here in the ULT in Philadelphia, to start off, we will give a short introductory talk on the Bhagavad Gita to lay the foundation for our study together. So, the Bhagavad Gita means, the words themselves mean the song of the Lord. It is said to be written by an ancient sage, Vyasa, about 5,000 years ago. And the content of the Bhagavad Gita is a dialogue taking place between Arjuna, a noble prince and warrior of the area, and Krishna. And who was Krishna? Krishna, of course, was a great teacher among the Hindus and is regarded to be an avatar. An avatar is the incarnation of a high spiritual being, one with deity. In essence, representing the perfection of the human being. But of course, aside from that personage, Krishna, the name itself, as we will see, is symbolic of several things. This text, the Bhagavad Gita, is an episode. It is a small part of a much larger text called the Mahabharata. The word Mahabharata means the great house of Bharata. And it, along with the Ramayana, are the two main epic poems of ancient India. The war that takes place between the two branches of the house of Bharata occupy about a quarter of the work, about 20,000 verses. And this episode we call the Bhagavad Gita is a very short episode that takes place in the during the middle of that war. So what we have of the tradition, the history, the story of this area is at the time there was a great kingdom ruled by the Bharatas. And there were two main branches, the older branch called the Kurus, and the younger branch of that tribe called the Pandus. So, this text, the Mahabharata, as we said, about a quarter of it, considers the war between these two branches of the Bharata family. And the Bhagavad Gita, as we said, is an episode that takes place on the battlefield just before a major and decisive battle of these two branches. So, as we move into chapter one, called the Despondency of Arjuna, chapter one is also sometimes called the Assembling of the Army. We are introduced to a few main characters. The first we hear about is an individual called Dhritarashtra. He is the king. The ruler of the kingdom, mostly in name, because in fact he is old, blind, and incapacitated, unable to lead. The actual running of the affairs of state, and who actually is the leader of the army of the Kurus, is his eldest son, Duryodhana. And Duryodhana, in a previous part of the Mahabharata, had contrived and convinced his father to banish his cousins, the five Pandu princes, of which Arjuna is one, from the kingdom. And after 13 years of wandering and hardships, the five Pandu princes had collected an army and were prepared to attack and regain their kingdom from their unjust oppressors. So the two armies are about to meet on the plain of Kurukshetra. And we see Krishna here is a wise teacher, but from Arjuna's perspective, he's a guide, an intimate friend, a companion. And in this particular role, he is acting as the charioteer for Arjuna. So the battle begins. There's a sounding of the shells, or the conch shells of the armies, a great noise, and a flight of arrows back and forth begins between the two opposing sides. And Arjuna begs his charioteer and friend Krishna to draw the chariot in the space between the two armies so he can get a better examination of the enemy, who he is fighting. Krishna does so and points out to Arjuna that amongst the lines of the enemy are numerous relatives and friends. And of course, as when he does this, Arjuna is horror-struck at the idea of having to slay his near relatives, old friends, companions. And as a result, he falls into a state of despondency. He throws down his bow and declares that he would rather die than be the murderer of his kin. And he says he will not fight. He's just overwhelmed with despondency. And considering his reputation for bravery and prowess in military combat, that was quite a situation. It was said that whosoever side Arjuna fought on, that side was sure to be the victor. And yet, faced with the prospect of having to take up arms against and possibly, most likely, kill his old friends and companions and relatives, he couldn't do it. And he says to Krishna, I am full of compassion and do not want to do any harm. Please tell me what I should do. And so that is the allegory. That is the tradition. That is part of the history. And if we just take it at its face value, it's an amusing tale. It's a poignant tale, inspiring, like any other epic, such as the Iliad or the Odyssey. But if we re read it with the symbolism given to us by the keys, which will help us unlock its meaning, it can tell us a lot more. And it's important for us to do that, as we're told in theosophy, that the myths, the legends, the stories of old were means of preserving and maintaining all kinds of information related to science, psychology, philosophy, ethics in these stories. And so each of these requires a key. And so, in order to make this most practical to us, especially in the West, we can use a psychological key, but we could also use the key of the evolutionary development of the human being. So we can take the larger picture over many lifetimes, or we can take the smaller picture, a microcosm of the larger picture. What's going on in this life? What's going on every day that we can get from this story, this book? And so, from the theosophical point of view, Dhritarashtra, that blind, old, incapacitated ruler incapable of governing, is really symbolic of the human body acquired by the immortal human monad in order to go through its evolutionary journey. So the body is necessary for experience on this plane, but in itself, without the inner faculties, it's pretty much useless and senseless, and in that sense, blind, incapacitated. So Kurukshetra then, literally meaning the plain of the Kurus where this battlefield takes place, is symbolic of physical life. And this, because this is where the battle is enjoying. This is where the divine immortal ego joins with the principles of its personality and body. This is where we have the blending of the material and spiritual streams of life. And this is where the battle between those two take place. This is where the self-induced and self-devised effort of the mind, the individual thinker, has to occur in order to further evolve. So the Kurus then and represent the material side of life, physical life as we know it, and also our material personal nature. The Pandavas, led by Arjuna, who is assisted by Krishna, represent the spiritual side of the human being. So we have spirit and matter, and what's in between is the mind, the thinker. And that's what Arjuna represents. And we'll see throughout the Mahabharata, this dialogue, that Arjuna, as the thinker, is having a dialogue with Krishna. Krishna here represents, in the individual sense, one's highest self, one's higher self, one's spiritual nature that one has to listen to and unite oneself with in order to accomplish this great mission. But in the larger sense, over time, we say that all souls are fundamentally identical with the universal oversoul, and all evolution is a journey of union through experience and knowledge gained and powers gained for the individual soul, the thinker, to unite itself through struggle and experience, through self-induced and self-devised effort, self-consciously with that oversoul, with that logos, with that universal manifested aspect of the divine absolute unknowable principle. So Krishna there represents, in the larger sense, the logos of which all souls are inseparable ray from. But in the individual sense, Krishna is our higher self. In terms of our principles, Atma Buddhi, whereas Arjuna is Manas, and the Kurus represent our personality and physical body. Now, as we see, though, there are wanderings and hardships. The Kurus at one point prevail, and in throwing out or discarding of our spiritual nature. And that's sort of representative of the ideas, even though this divine spiritual being incarnates into a physical body, it forgets, it loses sight of its spiritual nature. It's completely overwhelmed by the material side of life. And it may take time before it makes itself known, its presence strong enough. But when it does, the individual soul realizes that it has to gain control of this lower nature, this lower personal nature, and it has to listen to the higher and call upon its own nature to be victorious. So the wanderings and hardships that the Pandus go through for that 14-year, 13-year period are representative of not only the rise, the cyclic rise and fall of human beings and groups of people, but also the necessity of all varieties of evolutionary experience, especially those that give us difficulty and tests and trials to really draw out our knowledge and power. So we learn from the sufferings and trials of life. We learn how to eventually conquer this lower nature and make it an instrument rather than it being imposing on us. So these two hostile armies meeting on the field of Kurukshetra represent the human condition. They are the two aspects of our higher and lower faculties, our material and spiritual faculties. But they also represent any individual who, once they make the commitment that they are going to live from the higher voice within them, the voice of higher spiritual wisdom and altruism and intuition and aspiration, find that once they make that resolve, they face opposition. The opposition being symbolized here by the Kurus. And so that opposition can come from friends, from family, from associates, but it can also occur from the hereditary tendencies of our body, which of course are from karma, as well as the habits that we've built up over this life before we've made that struggle, and therefore are also due to our karma. So, faced with this opposition, each individual has to decide, will they listen to that higher self within in order to overcome and be victorious? So, we see then that there are various ways in which we can approach this Bhagavad Gita from the individual psychological point of view or the moral point of view. And throughout this, we want one of the main questions we want to answer for ourselves is, how can we take this metaphysical psychological treatise, this book written 5,000 years ago in a land far away, in a people that are remote to our memory, how can we take their lesson, their experience, and make it applicable in our everyday lives? Krishna, Arjuna at this point, facing all this opposition around him within and out, his nature is filled with doubt and fear and uncertainty, doesn't know how to act, is ready to give up. How many times in life do we or somebody we know face the same problems out of fear, doubt, uncertainty, just don't know what to do? And so what we want to draw together from the lessons we gain here in the Bhagavad Gita in order to do that. And as what we see, there are going to be several themes that are going to occur over and over again. There are 18 chapters to the Bhagavad Gita, each one except the first, called the Despondency of Arjuna, has to do with some aspect of devotion, how we unite ourselves self-consciously with that higher principle in nature. And we'll see 17 themes, several themes come through selflessness in our attitude, through right action, through recognition of the one spirit that unites us all, through altruism, through realization that we're not separate from one another, and recognize the importance of karma individually and collectively, and the relationship of our duty to that karma. So this then serves as a framework in which we can study the Bhagavad Gita together. And as we move into the second chapter here, pages 11 to 15, we're going to be introduced. It's called the Sankhya doctrine. And the reason it's called the Sankhya doctrine is the Sankhya has to do with our intellectual nature, how we apply our minds, how do we apply our reasoning, how do we apply our judgment to trying to understand the mysteries of life, how do we apply our mental understanding to the way we act, to the way we perceive and relate to things. So it's more of an intellectual approach, but we have to grasp here the fundamental ideas. So we will see in this second chapter, and this is why we take 3 weeks for it, that the entire philosophy, the entire intellectual approach, psychological approach, metaphysical, moral approach of the Bhagavad Gita is outlined, packed into this second chapter. And even if you had no opportunity to study anything else, if you've understood and grasped this second chapter, you pretty much have the gist and essence and basics by which you can apply the Bhagavad Gita. So we'll begin tonight with the second chapter. And just to set the scene, again, Arjuna has sunk down to his chariot, and Krishna tries to say, you're such a brave warrior. What's come over you that you would do such a cowardly, shameful thing? And Arjuna says, I am of a disposition which is affected by compassion and the fear of doing wrong. Please, there is no one else who I know better that can help me understand. My reason is completely confounded. And like he says, I should, will not fight. And this is where Krishna begins to encourage him to get out of this condition. And just as a spoiler, we'll say that Krishna is successful, and Arjuna joins the battle, and the Pandus are victorious and are able to regain their kingdom. And that is the Bhagavad Gita in a nutshell. So, but let's unpack that nutshell and get all we can of it, of its nutrition. So, we'll ask our first reader to begin on page 11, where Krishna is speaking, "Thou grievest for those," and go over to about the middle of page 12, ending with the words, "Resolve to fight."
Krishna is speaking. Thou grievest for those that may not be lamented, while thy sentiments are those of the expounders of the letter of the law. Those who are wise in spiritual things grieve neither for the dead nor for the living. I myself never was not, nor you, nor all the princes of the earth, nor shall we ever hereafter cease to be. As the Lord of this mortal frame experienceth therein infancy, youth, and old age, so in future incarnations will it meet the same. One who is confirmed in this belief is not disturbed by anything that may come to pass. The senses, moving toward their appropriate objects, are producers of heat and cold, pleasure and pain, which come and go and are brief and changeable. These do thou endure, O son of Bharata, for the wise man, whom these disturb not, and to whom pain and pleasure are the same, is fitted for immortality. There is no existence for that which does not exist, nor is there any non-existence for what exists. By those who see the truth and look into the principles of things, the ultimate characteristic of these both is seen. Learn that he by whom all things were formed is incorruptible, and that no one is able to effect the destruction of it which is inexhaustible. These finite bodies which envelop the souls inhabiting them are said to belong to him, the eternal, the indestructible, unprovable spirit who is in the body. Wherefore, Arjuna, O Arjuna, resolve to fight.
This spirit can
Yes.
never be destroyed in a mortal frame which it inhabiteth. Hence, it is unworthy for thee to be troubled for all these mortals.
Well, 1 second, please.
Yeah,
We'll,
where are we?
we need the second reader from.
Yeah, a second reader.
Yeah, I'm the second reader.
I'm sorry,
That's okay.
but I was.
A man who believeth that it is this spirit which killeth, and he who thinketh that it may be destroyed, are both alike deceived. For it neither killeth nor is it killed. It is not a thing of which a man may say, it hath been, it is about to be, or is it to be hereafter? For it is without birth and needeth not death. It is ancient, constant, and eternal, and is not slain when its mortal frame is destroyed. How can the man who believeth that it is incorruptible, eternal, inexhaustible, and without birth think that it can either kill or cause to be killed? As a man throweth away old garments and putteth on new, even so the dweller in the body, having quitted its old mortal frames, entereth into others which are new. The weapon divideth it not, the fire burneth it not, the water corrupteth it not, the wind drieth it not away. For it is indivisible, inconsumable, incorruptible, and is not to be dried away. It is eternal, universal, permanent, immovable. It is invisible, inconceivable, and unalterable. Therefore, knowing it to be thus, thou shouldst not grieve. But whether thou believest it to be of eternal birth and duration, or that it dieth with the body, still thou hast no cause to lament it. Death is certain to all things which are born, and rebirth to all mortals. Wherefore, it doth not behoove thee to grieve about the inevitable. The antenatal state of beings is unknown, the middle state is evident, and their state after death is not to be discovered. What in this is there to lament? Some regard the indwelling spirit as a wonder, whilst some speak and others hear of it with astonishment. But no one realizes it, although he may have heard it described.
The spirit can never be destroyed in the mortal frame which it inhabiteth. Hence, it is unworthy for thee to be troubled for all these worlds. Ask by thine eyes for the duties of thy particular tribe, and it will ill become thee to tremble. A soldier of the Kshatriya tribe hath no duty superior to lawful war. And just to thy wish, the door of heaven is found open before thee. Although this glorious unsought fight, which only fortune's favored soldiers may obtain, but it will not perform the duty of thy calling and fight out the field. Thou wilt abandon thy natural duty and thine honor and be guilty of a crime. Mankind will speak of thee, will speak of thy ill fame as infinite. And for one who hath been respected in the world, ill fame is worse than death. The generals of the armies will think that thy retirement from the field arose from fear. And amongst those by whom thou wert wont to be thought great of soul, thou shalt become despicable. Thine armies will speak of thee in words which are unworthy to be spoken, depreciating thy courage and abilities. What can be more dreadful than this? If thou art slain, thou shalt attain heaven. If victorious, the world shall be thy reward. Wherefore, O son of Kunti, arise with determination fixed for the battle. Make pleasure and pain, gain and loss, victory and defeat, the same to thee. And then prepare for battle, for thus and thus alone shalt thou in action still be free from sin. Thus before thee has been set the opinion with the son. Thus before thee has been set the opinion in accordance with the Sankhya doctrine speculative.
Thank you. So before considering your questions and comments, let's just summarize some of the main points here of this portion. So Krishna initially challenges Arjuna's despair and fleeing from the field of battle as unworthy of a warrior of his stature and born of ignorance. But then he goes on further to introduce him to some key spiritual principles, beginning with the immortality of the soul. And we'll see all this is predicated on that fundamental teaching of the immortality of the soul right from the beginning. One has to grasp that. And it presumes that an individual has gained some type of inclination of that understanding of the immortality of their soul and feels through that understanding that there is more to nature, there is more to themselves than this physical body and existence. So the eternal nature of the soul, it never dies. It is imperishable. And he gives some graphic examples of that. The body, though, is perishable. Death is inevitable. He talks about it in relation to the body. So being that death is an inevitable, and yet in our spiritual nature, we are immortal, sorrow over the death of the body is misplaced. Death of the body is natural, it's inevitable, and regeneration of everything physical, every physical form is regenerated into a new form is also inevitable. So what is there to despair? And then the other idea here is that his duty as a warrior, symbolic of the warrior soul. So the key ideas here are the immortality of the soul, the idea that the death of the body does not touch the real self, the importance of performing one's duty, the idea that in action, in the performance of one's duty, is not worthy of a human being, and that the concern is with the action. Our concern should be with the action, never with the personal fruits of those actions. So these are some of the key ideas that we can explore together. Any questions or comments you have on any part of this reading? Yes, Theosophy Hall or TK?
So it's really very logical, the reasoning he's using to Arjuna. He's mostly appealing to the personal man, his pride, his reputation, his standing in the world. But he's also saying, do you want to be thought of for the rest of your life as a coward? That's worse than death. There's no worse fate than that. So it's interesting that we would think most soldiers, they would snap out of it and do their duty. But it's interesting he goes to the personal first. And then, of course, he goes through all the other philosophical things. So it's almost like he's saying, look, snap out of it, get in there, do your duty. And then we'll talk about philosophy later. That's kind of what we're thinking.
Any insights as why Krishna, even though this is a spiritual, philosophical, metaphysical dialogue, and he's going to get into the spiritual key ideas, why does he be take such a personal approach and appeal to Arjuna as an ordinary human being personality? Why does he do that at the beginning?
That's my point.
Yes.
There's a follow-up.
Oh,
Yeah, the
follow up.
follow-up is he really an ordinary human being? Isn't he an officer in the army? Doesn't he have other people looking up to him? So it's he's more than when he's like there's been generals throughout history that they led the charge and they were thought of very highly. And there's been generals that have just been in the background and then they just direct the troops and they may be good strategists, but they're not in the thick of it with the troops.
Yes.
So
But the question is, okay, let's rephrase the question. Why does he appeal to his pride and self-regard first, as any human being might have, especially one who's in the position stated? Why is he taking such a personal approach to Arjuna, especially when he tells him to leave out the personal fruits of reward of actions? Why does he start there? Yes, MHW? Yeah, what's going
Well, we were thinking that maybe he's trying to address his lower nature. And by starting out with that, we were thinking that maybe he would be able to, that Arjuna himself would be able to address what Krishna was telling him in a more productive manner because it's his lower nature that is affecting him now.
Certainly, lower nature. Does that any other thoughts or contributions? Yes, Theosophy Hall.
Yes, we have a couple here. Yes.
We find Arjuna is despondent, so he's overwhelmed with an emotion, with his personal nature. So this is where Krishna begins, because he is stuck in his personal nature. He's trying to instigate that personal idea to look at it in a different way.
Okay. Just you said there were some other contributions. Yes.
Well, if this one portion here, which starts at the bottom of page 13, we can't help but think of it as an analogy. Yes, he's talking to, so he's using this, hey, look, you have a tribe. It's your tribe. Don't tremble in front of your tribe. You're a soldier. This is your duty. And if you do it, then heaven is found open before you through this fight. Okay. Now, if we use an analogy there, essentially, just as Arjuna is the leader of his tribe, he's a great officer, it also could be the higher self talking to our mind. And the higher self, metaphorically speaking, is saying to the mind, cast your duties into your lower self You need to take charge. It ill becomes you to tremble. It's a big job. You're the soldier. You're the Kshatriya. You have no higher duty superior to getting control of yourself. And then he says, and just to thy wish, the door of heaven is found open before thee. In other words, Booty is right there. So he's got a job to do, and yet he can look up toward Booty through this glorious unsought fight of gaining self-control, which only fortune's favored soldiers may obtain. And the fortune's favored soldier there are those among us, those in humanity, who are fortunate in this life to even learn these ideas, to give these ideas credibility, because it really means something. There's so many people. Most of humanity has no idea about this.
So, all these ideas are only indicative of how much we can draw from this deep well of spiritual knowledge contained in the Bhagavad Gita. But also consider this, that one of Arjuna's arguments is, I would it, for me to engage and kill my relatives would be despic I would be despised. How could I live with such shame? He already is an individual who is motivated by a high degree of pride and self-regard. So Krishna is recognizing that, but turning it around. Difficult use we might say he's spinning it. Says you're using your pride and self-regard to flee from the battle. Have you considered that your action to stay in the battle is more of service to you? But the other, another idea is, as human beings, just like Krishna, Arjuna, we have our higher aspirations, but we have our lower tendencies, our own individual degree of self-centeredness, self-regard, pride, and we have to begin with where we are. So, even though our aspirations may be very lofty and ideal, we still have to face life where we are as personalities and struggle to overcome that. And so, at the beginning, we approach it from where we are as persons not having a complete understanding of reincarnation, of the spiritual ideas. Yet, something resonates in us that this is true. And so we begin with where we are. And then in the voice of the silence, it says to make pride and self-regard bond maidens to devotion. In other words, acknowledge a certain amount of pride and self-regard in yourself. That's the truism. But in the beginning, you have to make it a servant to your devotion. And the rest of the Bhagavad Gita is all about ways in which we can be devoted. But rather than using that personality for its own means, rather than serving the personality to its own ends, discipline the personality to be a servant to something higher. And so we have to begin where we are. Any yes, MHW, you have another question or comment?
Can we ask a different question?
Yes, of course.
On page 14, we know it's funny how many times we've studied this, and we never realize that towards the bottom of page 14, it says, "If thou art slain, thou shalt attain heaven." And you're just wondering, is that a meta when he's saying heaven? Is that a metaphor for something else then? Because we know that there is no heaven to speak of.
Well, we do know from other things said very soon coming up in the Bhagavad Gita, in fact, next week, that there was very strong belief in heaven world or Devakan among the Hindus at that time. And the result of virtuous action, performing one's duty and bravely in the face of battle, if you did it for your community, for your family, with the right motive, that was deserving of heaven. And so we read, yes. Okay. The unwise, delighting in the controversies of the Vedas, tainted with worldly ideas, preferring a transient enjoyment of heaven to eternal absorption. So the idea of a heaven, which one could practice certain rituals or do certain virtuous acts, was very common and prevalent among the people. It's what we would call Devakam. So basically what he's saying, if you're victorious, then the world is yours. If you're slain in the course of a virtuous battle, then heaven is yours. So what's there to be hesitant about that? Once again, taking the personal point of view from the perspective of his ideas, his culture, where he's coming from. And there's a good lesson to that. If we're trying to help one with the Bhagavad Gita, we don't get right into the philosophy and metaphysics right away. We try to meet the person where they are, and introduce gradually some of these basic ideas, trying to draw it out by understanding, by questions and answers, and so forth. Yes, Theosophy Hall.
So now we're thinking, like, is he talking about heaven or Devakant? I mean, a Devakant state meaning equivalent to heaven, or could he be talking about nirvana? And we've never heard that discussed before.
Well, preferring transient enjoyment of heaven to eternal absorption, and the rest of that would be in
Okay.
nirvana, yes, or the
Okay.
equivalent. Okay, and also not just that, but they perform these ceremonies which promise rewards in future births. So there was not only reward in heaven, but doing things with self-regard and hope for rewards in a future life. So Krishna is making some observations about the natures of some devotees at that time. Yes, Theosophy Hall.
Well, in this instance, if we look at it as, really, Arjuna is interacting with Krishna in a conscious way. So let's just presume that he's pretty far along the path here. So so we could read this: if thou art slain, no, yeah, if thou art slain, thou shalt attain heaven. You're going to Devakant. If they take you out, you're going to Devakant. Okay, no. If you fail in this lifetime, you're going to Devakant. Let's assume he's in one of his last possible lifetimes. If you thou art slain, if you fail at gaining control of your lower nature, you'll go to Devakant. If victorious, the world shall be thy reward. So if victorious, you've overcome it. And in the philosophy of theosophy, that doesn't mean you go to what's it called? Not Devakant, but Nirvana. That doesn't mean you go to Nirvana. It means you have you're going to stay here, and the world is your reward. So you're here to benefit all of the world and assist in the evolution of the world.
So
That's one way to see it.
it's a sort of resignation, renunciation, humility, what Jesus was referring allegorically when he said, the meek shall inherit the earth. In other words, if you reach a certain degree of detachment and selflessness in action, the world is yours. Okay.
But
And if
remember,
you fail in that,
but the word meek to them is not
yeah.
like you're a wimp. That's not what the word meek meant to them.
Yeah, meek in terms of one's inner attitude of renunciation and selflessness. Yes, not weak in the terms of motivation or spirit or energy or conviction. Okay, so we have some interesting lines here. At the very beginning, it says here, "Thou grievest for those that may not be lamented." And it says here, the wise, those who are wise in spiritual things grieve neither for the dead nor for the living. Those who are wise in spiritual things grieve neither for the dead nor the living. What does that mean? Does that mean if we grieve, we are not wise? Does it mean that if we are wise, we don't empathize or have feelings for those who suffer from the loss, or have empathy or sympathy or understanding for those that suffer in the actions of life, experiences of life? What does it mean? Yes, Yasviho.
Well, certainly, all right, so those who are wise in spiritual things grieve neither for the dead. All right, so we're not talking about dead people and living people. We're talking about awakened people and those who are still asleep. And that doesn't mean that the wise people, the fact that they don't grieve for them, it doesn't mean they're not compassionate, but it simply means that they recognize everything's happening under law. He's brought it upon himself. I'm here if I can help, but I have other things to do with my time and effort than to get all sentimental about people who aren't taking care of themselves.
That too, but it still says wise in spiritual things.
Even though that may seem kind of,
yeah,
kind of harsh.
Well, the point phrase there is wise in spiritual things. And as we've said, the most important thing to realize from a spiritual perspective is the immortality of the self. The self is not touched by death. Our real nature, our real identity, is not touched or affected by the death of the body. The person we truly love, the being behind the blind and capable body who gave us so much joy, who we learned so much from, is not touched by death. We can commemorate, we can celebrate their qualities, their virtues, but the passing of their body is a natural phenomenon. It's necessary. It's change. It comes to all mortal beings and forms of beings. So there's nothing in there to grieve about. To be cast down or spend so much time in grieving it is, to a certain extent, an ignoring or an ignorance of those spiritual truths. So he says, though your sentiments are those who are expounders of the letter of the law. So the idea is getting beyond the sentiment to an actual realization, a knowledge of spiritual things. And then he goes, well, how do we do that? And that is, well, first, we have to understand in ourselves, recognize in ourselves what is indestructible, what isn't touched by the elements, by the conditions. What is like that person? What is left when we take off all the aspects of our personality, about to take off clothing and put it back on? What remains when all those outer things are shaved aside? And in that way, we learn to discover the reality, the spiritual reality of ourself, independent of anything physical. Yes, MHW.
We think to go along with that, and we think to go along, there's a chat, and we think our question goes along with the chat as well. On the top of page 14, when it says no duty superior to lawful war, we've always had an issue with that term lawful, because we always wondered how could you have a lawful war? But we were wondering now, could that term lawful, could law be actually talking about the theosophical perspective of law, you know, with, you know, in regards to the second fundamental, rather than a war being lawful in the, you know, in the personal sense, we guess.
Well, certainly that term lawful war can be taken from the perspective of a moral war, a just war, a war to reclaim what is rightfully yours that has been taken away. A lawful war can also be interpreted as confronting and facing and overcoming problems and things that come to you under the law of karma, and not running away from your duties or running away from things are difficult, but mastering them, overcoming them. And in the chat, it uses the term to kill. And Krishna starts out in this, you cannot kill the real nature of the being. The body does die and can be killed, but you cannot kill the real inner nature of any being, nor can they kill you. It's beyond. So from that perspective, we are not fighting against persons, but against ideas. We are confronting actions. We have to deal with actions and ideas and desires of other people that either are causing suffering to ourselves or suffering to others. So the definition of a soldier here or a warrior here, beyond the fact that it's Arjuna is the warrior, he's born into the warrior caste, and it's his duty to defend the helpless, to defend the weak, as much as it's the priest's duty to pray and perform the rituals. He has to do that. But from our perspective, to be the warrior means to be able to channel all our energies effectively in the accomplishment of a task, regardless of what the obstacles are, to overcome by the using of our own resources. And even Jesus says, you know, the kingdom of heaven has to be taken by violence. But what does that mean? What kind of violence? Yes, Theosophy Hall.
Yes, we have two comments here in Theosophy Hall. And the first one we would just mention, well, yes, it's an inner war that we're talking philosophically, and could there be literally a lawful war? Isn't it the case that HBV's teachers sent her to war to go and be the military advisor to Garibaldi in the War of the Papal States? And she was very influential in that war. She even took bullets. She even had her arm broken by the saber of another soldier. So when it's time to do what we have to do, it's time to do what we have to do.
And that's part of the point here, that duty, you should perform your duty, whatever it is, regardless of the personal consequences. In other words, make pain and loss, victory and defeat, the same to thee, to focus on the action and not the event. In other words, focus on the performance of the action of our duty, regardless of the event, the circumstances under which it can it occurs, and regardless of the personal consequences. That's the warrior attitude. That's the inner warrior attitude. Yes, another
comment. We had a second here.
Well, we were just reminiscing about the idea of grief. If you grieve neither for the dead nor for the living, it connotates an emotion. And therefore, detachment is the only way that you can overcome that, if you think.
So we'd like to finish up tonight. We only have a few more minutes, and ask for your contributions, questions, suggestions on how we can take these ideas and apply them to help others or help ourselves get through moments of indecision and fear, just like Arjuna. How can we take these ideas? Can we think of some practical examples or situations in our everyday lives, which is a
2 minutes.
Which we have to be warriors, overcome our fear, our pride, our indecision, what other people will think of us. What if I do the wrong thing? That type of thing. Any thoughts on that?
Just do it.
Just do it. Yes. Just do it. Why? Because we're a spirit. Nothing. A spirit, nature of spirit is action. Do it. Action. And it cannot be touched by the fruits of action, or it cannot be touched by the action of others. Also, the idea of reincarnation and karma. That's another spiritual truth, that being deathless, being indestructible, the spiritual part of our nature can only be re-embodied in some temporary form. We call that re-embodiment or reincarnation. And being a spirit being deathless and unchangeable, if it acts as it has to by its nature, it must receive the results of its action in this life or another, regardless of the time, because time is only of this world, the passing of time. What comes this in the spiritual realm, there's only eternal now, an eternal present. So next week, then, we will take up this idea of yoga, whereas the Sankhya deals with a speculative or a theoretical, the intellectual understanding of these spiritual truths. How do we take those spiritual truths and translate them into action, into devotion, mentally or physically or psychologically, whatever? And that is the basic meaning of the term yoga. So we'll finish up here and welcome you all to our meeting again on this Sunday morning relating to the recognition of law. And of course, our next Wednesday evening Bhagavad Gita class. So make it a good evening.
Bye, good everybody. Happy Fourth.
Bye. Thank you, guys.
Happy Fourth. Yeah.